Welcome to the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church. We hope our broadcast will bless you.
Three quick illustrations. 2 weeks ago, it's illustration number one, a woman came into my office at work. She had been told that her job at Dow was ending on July 31st. She was looking for another opportunity within the company. It was a very unique woman. She grew up in China. She had attended the best universities in China, and she had got a PhD from a major university in the U.S. I talked to her for a while. And during the conversation, I mentioned to her that we might have, in our business, a job opening in China. Would she be willing to go back to China? There was silence for a while. I could tell she was thinking. I was very surprised by her, what she said. She was worried about raising her kids in a Christian environment in China. She was willing to sacrifice her career to save her kids. That's humility. Example number two. I'm aware of a story through a special circumstance in one of our Adventist boarding academies. There was a student, occasionally our academies have contests and things with monetary rewards. The student had won a fair amount of money as a first place award, certainly enough to buy some of the electronic gadgets that kids like to buy these days. The student put the award money in a sealed envelope, wrote the name of the student on it, put it under the finance office door. That student had a bill that was over the limits and could have been asked to leave academy. It was done anonymously. That's humility. A couple months ago, example number three. Some of you may remember this. It's difficult to remember past sermons, but I talked a little bit about in a sermon about the Apostle John and how he had gone from being a son of thunder to the most humble of the disciples. And he was so humble, in fact, that he left his name out of the Gospel of John that he wrote five times when he referred to himself as an individual in the story. He referred to himself as the one Jesus loved. We talked a little bit about another translation that could be the one who Jesus kept on loving. Another example of humility, of a Bible character. By the way, I'll just mention this. We do have a sermon library now of audio CDs of sermons, and if there's any past sermon that you'd like to have, we have them all back there for like the last year and a half. If you'd like to listen to another sermon, if you missed Pastor Bentley being here or something you'd like to listen, we have sermons back there that you can get a free copy. But getting back to our topic, so the reality is that swallowing your pride can be enough to gag you, right? Eating humble pie, if we use these metaphors, it makes you wonder, does it? Could there be a culinary eating skill that God would like us all to master? It would be eating humble pie. I don't know if we serve that at our potlucks or not. Today, as you might have guessed, we're visiting another biography from the Bible. A story about a man who became the most humble man upon the face of the earth. The most humble. And so the sermon today is entitled, The Best Friend of Humility. Let's pray for a moment. Father in heaven, as we review this biblical story this morning, please teach us. Teach us some things about some of the most fundamentally important Christian principles that are spread throughout the Bible, are behind the Ten Commandments, you know, a principle that's just critically important to our lives. Bless us this morning and give us understanding. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, the story for this morning, it's one of those great rag-to-riches kind of stories, except this one goes from riches back to rags. It's about a man that was born as a slave, turned into a prince, and then turned into a fugitive killer who was on the run. I think the whole world loves this story about the Prince of Egypt. Today we're going to talk about just two, maybe three scenes out of this story. And the story, of course, is about the life, the unforgettable life of Moses. We're going to begin with the opening scene. Let's go to Exodus. Exodus, the second book of the Bible. Let's go to Exodus chapter 2. To give you some introduction to this story. It's a story we all know, but sometimes there's details that create a theme in our minds that unless we think about that theme, we don't really pick out those details. I hope you can learn something today from our review of this story that's probably well known to many of you. Exodus 2, verse 1. And a man of the house of Levi went and took his wife, a daughter of Levi. Levi, of course, is one of the 12 sons of Jacob. Where are they? They're in Egypt, of course. So we got the story. Boy meets girl, falls in love. Verse 2, so the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. So what's going on here? There is a subplot behind this story. Tucked away back in chapter 1, there's actually the tail end of another rags-to-riches story. Another Hebrew slave who got accelerated into prominence, became the prime minister of Egypt. You know who we're talking about, right? That's Joseph. There's a clue. Joseph is clued to in chapter 1. Joseph had brought his nomadic family from the north down to Egypt. Pharaoh, had, in respect for Joseph and what he had done, had given him the best land to live in, the land of Goshen, waived their taxes. And so these probably about 70 people that journeyed down to Egypt were actually a very fertile group. They started having kids, and they grew and they grew and they grew. They developed a fair amount of wealth because of the tax exemption. You can imagine it's sort of like the founding of our country, right? Started out as a colony, it grew and it grew and it grew and it started to become wealthy. All of a sudden we became an independent country. Today we're celebrating that, as you all know. Well, what happens next? The friendly Pharaoh dies. We don't know how many other pharaohs there are in between, but we get to the point where there is a new pharaoh. In Exodus 1, verse 8 says, and now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. So the favor that this group of people had evaporated away. Now we can do the arithmetic. If you have a fertility explosion, I'm sure this is what Pharaoh thought, eventually if this keeps going, they're going to outnumber us. So Pharaoh declares them all illegal aliens. That sounds a little bit like the United States too, right? Puts them into slavery. They begin building as slaves over many decades, it sounds like, some of the mighty cities of the pharaohs. So that's the subplot. We get back to our story. Because even though you can shackle the Hebrew women, their fertility doesn't stop and the babies just keep coming. Finally, Pharaoh says, we've got to do something about this. Every baby boy will be killed. Kill them all. No more boys. We've got enough of them. We've got too many of them. So that's why our mother is hiding her infant son, her newborn son. We have to know that mother's name is Jochebed. We also know that little boys can get pretty loud after a while. They get louder as they get older. They get stronger lungs and vocal cords. So we pick up the story at this point in Exodus 2. But when she could no longer hide them, this is in verse 3, she took an ark of bulrushes for him. She daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, laid him in the reeds by the riverbank. And his sister stood afar off. And we know that would be Miriam. His sister stood afar off, 12 years older, to know what would be done to the little baby. Verse 5, the daughter of Pharaoh just happened to, I think we can stop there. God's plan, do things just happen? This is a primary example. She may have thought it just happened, but God had a plan here. Things don't just happen in the plan of God. Slight detour here, that applies to us too, right? Things aren't going well in your life, health-wise. God is still in control. That's a little side lesson that comes out of this powerful story. So it just happened that the daughter of Pharaoh, verse 5, came down to bathe at the river. Her maidens walked along the riverside. And when she saw the ark among the reeds, she says, "Girls, hey, go get that basket for me." So they did, and she opens it up. Verse 6, when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion on him, and she said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." She recognized right away. So she has compassion, talks to her girl helpers, friends that were with her, and all of a sudden, surprise, surprise, someone materializes at her side and says, "Hey, do you need some help here?" Of course, it's Miriam. This princess wasn't born yesterday. She had to be a fairly bright person. I think she probably played along with this, in my opinion. Well, the girl comes and says, "Oh, by the way, would you like a mother who is able to nurse this baby, a mother who is still nursing?" And the princess, of course, puts two and two together here. This must be the older sister. The older sister knows where the mother is. Princess acts like she doesn't know what's happening. Well, can you imagine that? Somebody who can feed the baby. "Well, I'll tell you what, girl, why don't you get that woman and bring her to me?" And, of course, that's exactly what happens. So in verse 9, Pharaoh's daughter says to the mother, we know that's Jochebed now, "Take this child away and nurse him for me." Look at this very unusual situation, because what also is promised is she will pay the mother to take care of the baby. So God has turned the situation around so that instead of a situation of deathly fear, the mother's getting paid for what she wants to do anyway. I think a lot of moms would probably appreciate that arrangement. So Exodus 2, verse 10, and the child grew. Surprise, surprise, the child grew. She brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she called his name Moses, saying, "Because I drew him out of the water." Now, people that study these things have argued how long Moses must have been with his parents. Some people say it was just 2 to 3 years, maybe, while he needed special care. Other people argue that maybe it was to the age of around 12, which in the Hebrew society was when kids became more mature. Ellen White, actually, in Patriarchs and Prophets, agrees with the second view. She says Moses was about 12. Also adds that the mother and father worked diligently to prepare this young child for something special. They realized that a miracle had been done. Several weeks ago, Pastor Bentley had a sermon where he talked about the prophetic gift. Some of you, I hope, remember that. Most of you were here. He talked about Ellen White and the fact that the remnant church, or the church of God's end time, one of its signs is that it has a prophet, a prophetic gift. He talked about Ellen White. I'd like to propose to you that one of the marvelous things that Ellen White has done, I believe she was a prophet, is that she takes some of these stories and she adds the little extra little bits that make the story really come alive and allow us to really get a lesson from it. And if you like Bible stories, if you like the Old Testament Bible stories, I'd recommend Patriarchs and Prophets. I'm going to give you a couple examples today. If you like the New Testament, Desire of Ages, stories about Jesus and the Gospels, both wonderful books that if you read the Bible story and you read this in parallel to that, you will be truly blessed. So I'm going to share some examples from Patriarchs and Prophets, some of the insights that she gives into this story as we go through the sermon today. So here's one of the insights. I think it makes a pretty stunning point. We are familiar with mothers who are expecting children, mothers that have young children. And Patriarchs and Prophets has something very special to say about this situation. It's a lesson for us. Here's the quote. How far-reaching in its results was the influence of that one Hebrew woman, and she an exile and a slave. She was a nobody. The whole future life of Moses, the great mission which he filled as a leader of Israel, testifies to the importance of the work of the Christian mother. There is no other work which can equal this. I'm not going to preach about this particular topic, but as we all know, when kids are about to appear in a family, there's usually a discussion about the mother and her role. In this particular case, this mother played a very special role in taking care of this baby Moses. If I read on, to a very great extent, the mother holds in her own hands the destiny of her children. Let every mother feel that her moments are priceless. Her work will be tested in the solemn day of accounts. Then it will be found that many who have blessed the world with the light of genius and truth and holiness hold the principles that were the mainspring of their influence and success to a praying Christian mother. So buried in this story is a message for moms. There's a message for dads in here too, but this one is an obvious one for moms. Praying moms, you keep praying till either your child or you die. Never give up. So now, this story fast forwards 30 years, plus or minus. They're gone. The interesting thing is we would not know anything about what happened in those 30 years except for some clues in a completely unexpected other part of the Bible. This story actually has more written about in the New Testament than in the Old Testament. Isn't that amazing? I don't know if you realize this. The Old Testament is pretty sketchy about some of these parts, but the New Testament, there's a couple instances where a lot of details are given about what happened. It's pretty clear the New Testament church and the people knew this story. This was an important story to the Hebrew culture. And so we end up with a situation where Stephen is defending himself in his trial. He doesn't know it yet, but he only has a couple hours to live. And he's talking about the history of God's leading his people. And all these people that are wanting to condemn him, he's telling them the story of Moses. Let's go to Acts chapter 7. Stephen is, in a sense, defending his life here, but in reality, he is ministering to these people in their hard hearts. With these tremendous stories. And so Stephen includes, and it's written down here, Paul is probably the one that heard this and touched his heart, I'm sure. He wrote it down here. The book of Acts, we believe. Again, Stephen's going to be stoned at the end of this chapter. We're in chapter 7. Let's look at verse 20. So he's going through this historical account, and he comes to the story of Moses. Verse 20, and at this time Moses was born, and was well-pleasing to God, and he was brought up in his father's house for 3 months. That's not new information at this point. Verse 21, but when he was set out, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up as her own son. Verse 22, notice this. This is new. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. It's interesting that if Moses actually wrote Exodus, he didn't put that in there. Little side note, if someone in the New Testament actually wrote down those details, I think you might catch the implication there. So Stephen is summarizing these nearly 30 years that Moses has lived as, you know, in the palace of Pharaoh. No one else writes anything down about this. Stephen comes along here and he says, oh, by the way, Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. He was mighty in the words and deeds. Now that probably shouldn't be a surprise to us. He was the adopted son of a princess. The princess of Egypt would want him to have the best education possible. So in our kind of language, he went to the greatest universities of the world. He sat at the feet of the brightest intellects. He was, in fact, trained as an officer in the world's mightiest army. Probably sat in the classrooms of the world's most brilliant jurists. Let's come back to patriarchs and prophets. It adds some additional details here. At the court of Pharaoh, Moses received the highest civil and military training. The monarch had determined to make his adopted grandson his successor on the throne. So this is the grandson, and the Pharaoh wants to make him the new Pharaoh, his successor. And the youth was educated for his high station. His ability as a military leader made him a favorite with the armies of Egypt, the prince of Egypt, and he was generally regarded as a remarkable character. It's a pretty high-flying life. It's interesting, we have to go to the New Testament and Ellen White to learn that. So 30 years have fly by. Moses is in this wonderful, unbelievable world. Stephen's defense a little bit later makes it clear that he never forgot that he was a Hebrew. He was a child of the Almighty Creator God. He's one with the slave race, but he's also one with God. And Stephen points out that Moses never forgot that. Go back to Acts 7, verse 23. Now when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. We don't know exactly what happened to prompt this. Ellen White suggests that angels may have made a special visit to him. Say it's time to act, Moses. We don't know for sure. But anyway, it came into his heart. Another New Testament reference, Hebrews 11, this Bible Hall of Fame chapter, all right, has a few more details of the Old Testament story. Hebrews 11, 24. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater than riches, than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward, the true reward. So at this point, it looks like the die was cast, right? The decision was made. Moses is going to begin the work of freeing his people. All right, Ellen White, Patriarchs and Prophets, again, has another very interesting statement. And this starts to come to the punchline of our topic this morning. Angels instructed Moses that Jehovah had chosen him to break the bondage of his people. He, that's not God, that's Moses, supposing that they would obtain their freedom by force of arms, expected to lead the Hebrew hosts against the armies of Egypt. So who decided that? Did God decide that? Whose idea was this? It was Moses' idea. So even though he had been chosen by God to do this tremendous, important task, rescuing God's people, Moses made a bad choice. We're going to do this militarily. I'm the one. I've got all this training. I'm the leader. So one, we know the story, one sunny afternoon he steps off his chariot. There's this Egyptian taskmaster that's beating the daylights out of one of the slaves, one of his Moses' fellow brethren. No mercy. Let's go back to Acts. Sorry, we're jumping back and forth, but this is a multidimensional story here. Acts 7, verse 23, I'll just read this to you. It says, "Now when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian." The Exodus 2 account says he looked this way and he looked that way and he didn't see anyone watching. And he struck down the Egyptian. I would propose that when you're trained as a warrior, you're trained as a general, this wasn't a big deal to accomplish. He'd had all the military training, the best in the world. A few carefully placed military moves and the Egyptian's dead. He's gone. Exodus 2 tells us that he covered up the murdered Egyptian with some sand, thinking that the story was over. Phase 1 of the great rescue was completed. The next day, there's problems. We go back to Acts for this. Acts verse 25. A few more clues here. Acts 7 verse 25, "For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand." He expected that once he took control, became the leader, they would just all fall in line behind him. They didn't do that. Well, how did they react? Well, verse 26. "The next day he appeared to two of them," this is Moses, "as they were fighting, and tried to reconcile them, saying, 'Men, you are brethren. Why do you wrong one another?'" Now this is interesting. The Acts account here says, "But he who did his neighbor wrong," that's one of the fighting men, all right, "pushed him away," pushed Moses away. All right? This is a slave pushing the prince of Egypt, pushing him physically. Stephen catches that little detail. "Who made you a ruler and a judge over us?" That's what the slave asked Moses. Is that something you ask a prince? Who gave you the power and authority? It's an embarrassing question. What really is the answer? Who had given Moses the authority to do this? Moses. Moses had chosen to do this. All right? God had put him in a special situation. God had placed him in a position of power, but Moses was the one that chose this route. And then we have the fateful words. At that instant, the slave looks into the prince's face and says, "Hey, I suppose you're going to kill me now, like you slaughtered the Egyptian yesterday." Moses knows it is over. Word is out. The sand had not hidden the deed. So if we want to talk big, we can talk about Destiny's Plan A, all right? The big plan just crashed and burned because of Moses. The record reads Acts 7:29, "Then at this saying, Moses fled and became a dweller in the land of Midian." Talked about that in our scripture reading. Moses fled. He was a colossal failure. He's got a death warrant on his head. He was truly a failure. 40 years of planning, of God's mission, parents working and ministering to their child, it was all gone. So I think we can understand what this must have meant to Moses, what it must have meant to his parents. And I think sometimes when we are faced with failure, maybe this story can help us. This was an enormous failure. And it was Moses himself, his fault. the choice that he made caused this to happen. It was a very public failure. You look at the failures that we can have. There can be all sorts of failures in our lives. Failures in love, failures in business, our careers, marriages, school. There can be private failures, there can be public failures. I think all of us have experienced a failure in our lives, and we know the meaning of that word. Probably not to the extent that Moses understood it or felt about it, but we've all had big failures too. And so we can get, in our lives, we can get this sort of dreaded letter grade, the grade F. Failure can be so bad you can taste it. It can make your gut get knotted up. It's not fun. It can be disastrous to a lot of dreams and goals. It's not fun crashing and burning as the rest of the world watches. Then we come back to this marvelous story. The story of the failure of Moses. 40 long years drag by. This is the second 40 years. 40 years in the desert of Midian. All those dreams of leadership, all those dreams of being called by God to rescue his people. It's all gone. Absolutely gone. All Moses has is a flock of dumb sheep and a barren desert. Yeah, he's got a wife, a couple sons. The world doesn't really, certainly at that time, didn't necessarily measure your accomplishments by your family. Certainly not to the extent that the opportunities that Moses had. Moses has definitely failed. But, catch this, I think in a most strangely sort of counterintuitive way, we can say that it was a successful failure. If there is such a thing, a successful failure. Patriarchs and prophets. Shut in by the bulwarks of the mountains, Moses was alone with God. The magnificent temples of Egypt no longer impressed his mind with their superstition faltered. In the solemn grandeur of the everlasting hills, he beheld the majesty of the Most High, and in contrast realized how powerless and insignificant were the gods of Egypt. Everywhere the Creator's name was written, Moses seemed to stand in his presence and to be overshadowed by his power. Now catch this. This is a critical punchline. Here, his pride and self-sufficiency. What's John White saying here? I believe this is God saying this to us. What was that? His pride and self-sufficiency were swept away. In the stern simplicity of his wilderness life, the results of the ease and luxury of Egypt disappeared. Moses became patient, reverent, and humble. What was the last word? Humble. And now catch this. If you thought it was good at this point, look at what Ellen White says at this point. She actually quotes the Bible, Numbers 12, verse 3, that declares that Moses was very meek and above all men which are upon the face of the earth. What was that? Moses was the most meek of everybody on the earth. That's quite a transformation. All right, so here's the punchline of the sermon. Apparently, failure is the best friend of humility. Failure is the best friend of humility. I think God sometimes allows us to fail. I think he maybe has this sort of hard to understand hope that if we can successfully fail, he can help us. So we have this concept of a successful failure. A failure is good in God's eyes because it stunts our ego, it wounds our pride. A lot of these things that are counterproductive to a Christian lifestyle, it shuts those down for a while. And I think that makes failure a very good friend of humility. When we're more teachable, when we aren't the boss, when we aren't in charge, I'll make up a word here. I'd say we're more humbleable, right? We're more humbleable when we've failed. So failure, I would argue, can be the best friend of humility. I have a friend at work. It's a different person I mentioned earlier. A good friend. She's a woman. Worked closely with her for a while. She also found out that her job with Dow will end on July 31st. She's an experienced chemical engineer. She loves her job. She was a middle-level management person. By the way, one of the most caring managers that I've known for some time. She's the primary breadwinner for her family. She's got two kids that are nearing college. She's facing career failure. She's come to my office several times, and she's told me that she's prayed about it. She's put it in God's hands. She doesn't know what's going to happen. Could this be a successful failure? God answers prayers sometimes in ways that we don't understand. Maybe that means restoring the job. Maybe it means another job. Maybe it means no job. But God can take those situations and make successful failures out of them. That's the message of this story that we're talking about today. So, what does that mean in practical sense? What kind of failures do we have? And how do we deal with them? For example, if I have a failure in my business or in my job, I'm supposed to just say, yeah, I'll embrace that. Yep, that's okay. Maybe I have failure in school. There's a class that's critical for my degree program and I get a grade that's too low. Am I supposed to just embrace that and say, yep, that's, I really like that? Maybe it's a marriage situation. Things are not going well. I'm supposed to just embrace that and say, yep, that's fine. I'm happy with that. You could make a long list. Maybe I've practiced healthy Adventist living forever, and prematurely my health has just failed. Am I supposed to be happy about that and embrace that? I think the answer is, in a certain sense, yes. Because God is in control. Those can be successful failures when God, we trust God and He really takes care of us. All right, I'm going to give a quick quote from a book called Humility. It's written by Andrew Murray. This is one of the things that he says. He says, the great goal of the spiritual journey is to be humbled over and over again. Ouch, that doesn't sound good, does it? The successful Christian journey, to be humbled over and over again through failure. He says, accept with gratitude everything which God allows from within or without, from friend or enemy, in nature or in grace, to remind you of your need of humbling. And to help you do it, believe humility to indeed be the other virtue, the very first duty before God and the one perpetual safeguard of the soul. Set your heart upon it as the source of all blessing. He said, well, that's not the Bible. That's what is he really right? How do I know he's right? Well, I would propose that he got that straight from Jesus. Many, many examples. Here's a couple. Matthew 11:29, Jesus said, come to me and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart. Matthew 23:12, Jesus talking, whoever exalts himself will be humbled, but whoever humbles himself will be exalted. John 13:4-5. So taking a towel, he washed their feet. What was that? He was doing something for somebody else that was a very humble task. I would say he was embracing a failure of his disciples. And I think for the fact that Jesus did that through God's help, he was strengthened. It was a humbling experience for Jesus. And then we all, of course, know the ultimate demonstration for Jesus, that he dies this despicable criminal death on the center cross. Was that a successful failure? Better believe it. So apparently we need to come to a place where life, where we can actually accept what humbles us, our failures, and rejoice, if at all possible, that God is in control, that he's there to help us. It's just his way, I think, of telling us there's more work to do in our lives. And I think if we look at Jesus' life, you could wonder why was he so calm? All the things that happened, all the things he was challenged with, all the dangerous situations he went into, going through the cross experience, he was calm. You spit in my face, okay, that's all right. You curse me, that's okay. You say something bad about me, that's okay. I wonder sometimes if Jesus wasn't being strengthened and humbled, and his humanity was being humbled by some of those situations that came to him. All right, so let's think this through. We're going to embrace everything that people, every bad thing that happens to us? Well, it's not that easy, is it? There's always someone who says, well, I did a little bit of research. I think it's actually this way. I think you're actually wrong. Hair stands up on the back of your neck to sort of say, I'm not so sure about that. And then you find out you're wrong. It happens all the time, right? We need to learn as Christians to react in a different way. Thank those people. Appreciate them for what they are. Sometimes they bring humbling experiences to us. But that can be a good thing, depending on how we react to it. So if we really took this to heart, I think we'd look at people differently, we'd look at things differently, we'd look at pain differently, we'd look at suffering differently. We'd probably look at almost everything differently. It's sort of a foreign way to look at bad things that happen to us. I think we'd have much more peaceful lives. I think God would be able to work on our characters. So 40 years are gone. 40 years looked like an absolute utter failure, a total wash. But somewhere in the Bible, it says, man looked on the outward appearance, but God looked on the heart. 40 years go by, graduation day. They're about to hand out the diplomas. The great teacher says, wait a minute. One more question on the final exam. That question is to us and to Moses. Have you learned the lesson of humility? So there's this voice that comes out of the roaring, burning up bush, stops Moses. One more exam. Now, if that exam would have been given 40 years earlier, how do you think Moses would have answered the question? Well, we sort of know. We go back to Acts 7:22. Moses says, hey, come on, I've learned all the wisdom of the Egyptians. I am mighty in works. I am mighty indeed. I'm ready. Do you need a leader? I'm here. 40 years ago, he had failed the exam. So now 40 years later, after that first failure, the exam comes back. How did he do? Let's go back to Exodus 3 now. You've got this crackling, roaring orange fire bush, and it's talking. We know it's God talking. What's Moses doing? He's down on his face. He's taking his sandals off. His face is planted in the dirt. It's actually not too bad a place to answer God, right? His head is bowed. The voice from the crackling fire speaks. Exodus 3, verse 10. Come now, therefore, and I will send you. I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. With his face still in the dust. Then Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? The voice in the orange bush cries back, I will certainly be with you, and this shall be a sign to you when you have brought the people out of Egypt, and you shall serve them on this mountain. You all know that Mount Sinai was in that vicinity. And Moses answers, go to chapter 4, verse 10. Moses says to the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent. Neither before or since you have spoken to your servant, I am slow of speech, slow of tongue. Time out. Is that what he would have said 40 years before? We know from some of these suggestions in Acts and other places that that's probably not what his answer would have been. And now he's saying, I've got a slow tongue. I've got a slow mouth. You've got the wrong man, God. And the voice in the orange still speaks. Verse 11. So the Lord said to him, who has made man's mouth? Or who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, or the blind? Have not I the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall say. Verse 13, Moses says, O my Lord, please send someone else. I can't do it. Moses passes the exam. He's now ready to lead. Because at last he knows that he is nothing. And so it is, friends, that Moses became the greatest and the humblest man on earth. I think proving true that failure is the best friend of humility. If we would only embrace the things that humble us, just like Moses did, and just like Jesus did.
You have been listening to the broadcast from the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church at 2420 East Ashman in Midland, Michigan. If you are in the area, we cordially invite you to visit our church Saturday mornings. If you are a distance away, we encourage you to continue visiting our website and weekly podcast at midlandsda.org.